You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Oh, there's a lot of people in there, and that sounded like this. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You've had several cups of coffee. Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon.
That's what I'm talking about. I go to a Black Baptist church. We always have to be loud when our pastor says good afternoon or good morning. I want to say thank you, everybody, for taking a chunk of your time today to come to this very important event that we have. Today, we have the pleasure of having a young woman that I have read her stuff, and I'm sure many of you are here for her as well, with regards to the algorithmic economy, and I'll formally introduce her shortly, as well as the new paper that we have released at Brookings, which is online today. And so we're very happy to announce this paper and a series of other projects that fall within our artificial intelligence initiative here. We at Brookings see the algorithmic economy as part of a broader debate on the responsible and ethical use of artificial intelligence systems. And as a result of that, we plan to publish, and discuss to ensure that we have a world in which we respect disciplines within this area as well as the application so that no one gets hurt. So I'm really excited to have as part of this discussion a presentation of this new paper with my co-authors that are also here today, who I will also formally introduce in just a moment. I am Nicole Turner-Lee. I haven't introduced myself. I am a fellow in the Brookings Governance Studies Department at the Center for Technology Innovation, of which algorithms are one part of my research portfolio. I have a book coming out, hopefully next year, on digital inclusion, and I also work on a range of regulatory and legislative policy issues. So again, I welcome all of you. So let's jump right into it, because I know in D.C. to get 45 minutes of anybody's time is hard, but to get this chunk of time that we've actually demanded of you is even more difficult. So we better be interesting, and we better be engaging, and be responsible in our use and respectful of your use of time. But I'm particularly excited as we put this event together to reach out to someone, again, that I have read her work and just been in awe of her conclusions, and that would be Kathy O'Neill. I started to put together a formal bio or introduction of her, but I went to a page that she recently put together. You know, her handle on Twitter is @MathBabe. So I have to ask her about that. But when you go to that website, she basically starts out by saying that she hopes to someday have a better answer to the question, what can a non-academic mathematician do that makes the world a better place? And I think for many of us in this room who sit in the belly of a place where there are constant policy challenges, that is a question I think that should guide much of our work as we move forward. Kathy is the mathematician and the author of the book Weapons of Math Destruction, which lays out this argument for what I consider to be algorithmic decency. She was the former director of the Leti Program in Data Practices at Columbia University Grad School of Journalism. She was a data science at Johnson Research Labs, and prior to that, she worked in the finance industry, and after leaving that, became part of Occupy Wall Street and an alternative financing movement, and her book has been recognized as a National Book Award for Nonfiction. She has a new book coming out in 2021 on the shaming culture of our society in which we're in. And I would say, added to this, outside of being a person who lives in a city where I'm from, New York, and a mother and a wife and a woman with blue hair, that she understands this space enough to give us some guideposts for what we should do in our discussion following. I'm going to bring up Kathy in just a moment, but to ease some time, she will be joined by my next favorite person. After she's done, actually, I'll come up and talk about our paper, and then she will be joined by my next favorite person, which is my boss, Dara West, who is the vice president here at Brookings and the director of our Center for Technology Innovation, who will lead the discussion with my two co-authors, Jeannie Barton, who is the former president and CEO of the Institute for Marketplace Trust at the Better Business Bureau, and a member of the IAPP Research Board, and Paul Resnick, who is at the University of Michigan, whose work focuses in the area of informatics. He has, like, several titles, long enough to be its own book. He's also an acclaimed author. He's a computer scientist, a data scientist, and an engineer by all trades. So with that, let us welcome Kathy O'Neill to the stage.
Thank you.
Wow, what an introduction, and it's my honor to be here. I only have 20 minutes, so I'm going to get going. So I wanted to tell you that as a data scientist myself, and actually I started my life as a mathematician, but I became a quant at D.E. Shaw in 2007. I actually was very naive about what I was walking into. I thought that models were facts, and they would sort of use math. I was going to be using math to like make the market more efficient. Ha ha ha. Then the crisis happened. D.E. Shaw was 20% owned by Lehman Brothers, so it was pretty close up. I actually worked with Larry Summers there. I couldn't help but notice that the AAA ratings of mortgage-backed securities played a big part in that crisis. It inflated the bubble, if you will. And it was, in fact, a mathematical lie. It was my first touch into how destructive algorithms can be, especially when they're endowed with too much trust, which is what the AAA ratings for mortgage-backed securities were. They were risk models for mortgages that we should have known better than to give AAA ratings to. And people trusted them because they trust mathematics. That is actually an abuse of trust of mathematics. And I was embarrassed for us. And what I realized was that, and when I say for us, I was embarrassed for the mathematicians that had sold out in that sense. What I realized that they were no more than opinions, but they were sort of couched in the language of science and mathematics, and people sort of endowed them with trust. So before I go on, I want to do the opposite of that, and I want to tell you what I mean by an algorithm. This is my son, Wolfie. He loves Nutella. Why am I showing you a picture of my son, Wolfie? Because I want to show you exactly what I mean when I say that algorithms are opinions embedded in math. We all use algorithms on a daily basis. Algorithms are just, when I say algorithms, I mean predictive algorithms, the typical ones being used right now to decide who's worthy of a job, who's worthy of a loan, who's worthy of getting fired, things like that. I'll give you examples, but it's prediction, predicting the future based on the past, looking for patterns in the past, patterns in particular of sort of initial conditions that led to success to decide whether this initial condition in front of us will lead to success. That's what an algorithm is. Very simple. And we do it every day. When you decide what to wear, you're doing that. When I decide what to cook for my family, I do that. And that's the example I'm going to focus on. What do I need to decide whether my dinner will be a success? Well, I just need historical data. And this is typical for any algorithm. You need historical data and a definition of success. That's literally all you need. You're going to look for patterns in historical data that led to success in the past. And given something now, you're going to say, does that look like something that was successful in the past? If so, I'm going to predict it will be successful in the future. That's it. So for me, cooking a dinner is like, well, what kind of data will I need? Well, mostly memories. There's sort of informal data, memories in my head. What was successful in the past? As well as, of course, what do I have in my kitchen to cook with? How much time do I have? And I've already lied to you. And this is one of the ways that opinions are embedded. I don't use all the ingredients in my kitchen. My kids, my teenagers, have a lot of junk food. I blind myself to the junk food. Those are not true ingredients for food, for dinner, right? We all do that. We blind ourselves to things that we find inconvenient. We decide what's relevant data, always, of course. Then after I cook the dinner, I decide whether something was successful. And then I will use that information to update my model going forward. That's what we do. We optimize to success by updating information every single time we see the answer. We say, was it successful? Yes, make more meals like this. Was it not successful? Do not make more meals like this. That's how we do it. Well, and this was where the real point is. What is my definition of success? What is my definition of success for a meal for my kids? Answer, did my kids eat vegetables? Right? What would his definition of success be? Did I eat Nutella? Okay, so the two things are, it matters, right? The definition of success matters a whole lot to how we optimize over time. The second thing to keep in mind, though, is that I got to define success for my kids' meals because I'm in charge. The people in power decide what success is. And when they tell people who are the targets of those models, trust me, this is math, what you should be thinking instead is, actually, I don't trust you because you've defined success to work for you, but not necessarily for me. That's what my son would say, although tough luck with that. What we have now is a situation where we have a bunch of people building algorithms, hiding behind the authority of mathematics, mostly white guys, who tell us to trust them because it's math. And I want you to think, I will not trust you until you explain to me what you mean by success and show me how it actually works out for people like me or for people of all types. And I have a word for the worst offenders of this type of failure, because they do have, there are plenty of examples of failures along these lines. I call them weapons of math destruction. They're characterized with three properties. They're widespread, important algorithms making decisions about a lot of people that matter to those people. I usually categorize it either as a financial decision, a decision around your livelihood, getting a job, keeping a job, or your liberty, how you're policed, how you're sentenced, how you're paroled. They're secret. We don't understand their scores. There are scoring systems that we don't get to see the formula. We don't get to see the formula, and they're important. Guess what? That's a recipe for disaster. Because if they're wrong, we can't appeal them. We're told it's proprietary. Sorry, you can't know how this works. Whether it's facial recognition software or it's who gets an interview when you apply for jobs. We're not allowed to know how our scoring works. And the third thing is, when that's a situation where it's important but it's secret, no appeal system, it messes up sometimes and it's destructive for the individual. And it's not just destructive for the individual, it's destructive for society. That's my observation in these examples. And the first example comes from the world of education reform. It was actually one of the centers was here under Michelle Rhee, if you remember her. She fired the principal live television. The idea was, let's get rid of the bad teachers so the achievement gap will get smaller. That was the political rhetoric for a couple of different presidents. It was pretty nonpartisan. The idea was, the achievement gap, by the way, is the gap between standardized test scores on average for rich kids versus poor kids. It was growing over time, over the decades. Not because poor kids were doing worse, they were actually doing better, but because rich kids were getting better faster. And the idea was to close this gap, let's get rid of bad teachers. Now, as an aside, that gap has existed anytime we've ever measured it, wherever we've measured it. It's probably more of an artifact of inequality itself. So the fact that it's growing is probably an artifact of the fact that inequality is growing. But the political rhetoric was bad teachers are the problem, let's get rid of them. So we had to find them first. And the way we find them is through data. We had this thing called the value-added model for teachers. And it was supposed to find the bad teachers, the ones that had bad scores, and then we could get rid of them. And that's what Michelle Rhee did, actually. She fired Sarah Wysocki, along with more than 200 other teachers the same year, 2012, based on an algorithm called the value-added model that no one could understand, no one could explain, and which we have pretty good evidence was not much better than a random number generator. Now, I know that the theme of today is bias in the algorithms or AI. But I want to sort of broaden that to, like, what does bias mean writ large? And for me, this means we have to include the way people think about data. People trusted this stuff because it was literally presented as a magic bullet that could tell you whether a teacher was good or not, even though it was actually a random number generator. Imagine a Martian coming down from Mars saying, oh, I can tell you which teachers are bad. Here's a list of them. They have terrible scores. The other teachers are good. You should keep them. Would we trust that Martian? We would not, because we'd be like, Martian, what's your definition of good versus bad? We would need to understand that before we trust you. But we did trust this. That's our bias. That's our bias in how we think about data and AI and algorithms. Here's another story. This is Kyle Beam. He was prevented from getting interviewed for a job. He had to take a personality test. It was a Kroger's grocery store bagging job at a grocery store. He was eminently qualified, but he got red-lighted on the personality test that he was forced to take. I should say that most people, the majority of people trying to get minimum wage work in this country, have to take personality tests. If they fail, they will not get an interview. They get red-lighted from this process. Kyle was lucky in three different ways. The first thing was he found out he failed. Most people just never get called back, but he had a friend who told him he failed. The second way Kyle was lucky, his dad is a lawyer. Most people trying to get that kind of job don't have access to a good lawyer. His dad was a lawyer. And the third thing that was lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, is he recognized some of the questions on the personality test. Because he had been treated for bipolar disorder in a mental hospital recently, and he recognized them as coming from the mental health assessment he had had at the hospital. It's called the five-factor model. You might recognize it as the same test that Cambridge Analytica used on Facebook. So when he told his dad he recognized those questions, his dad said, oh my God, that's not legal under the Americans with Disability Act. You're not, the ADA stipulates that you cannot be required to take a health exam, including a mental health exam, as part of a job requirement. So his dad quit his job in M&A law. This is in Atlanta. He looked around. He got Kyle to apply to six other companies that all were using the exact same test, and they were all big box stores. Lowe's was one of them. Yum Foods, which owns Taco Bell's, was one of them. So he wasn't just denied from this one job. He failed all seven tests. He was denied work at many, many, many places. And his father then filed class action lawsuits against all seven companies on behalf of anybody who'd ever taken the test. And it's still in court. And we can talk about the extent to which regulators can or cannot understand how algorithmic harm actually works. That's a different kind of bias, of course. It's just literally old-fashioned bias against people with certain characteristics that we have embedded into algorithms in an obvious way in this case, but in less obvious ways, I would stipulate in the future. I don't think this is going to end, to be clear. I think that personality tests are going to, people who build personality tests are going to be better at hiding it. You guys might have heard about Amazon's recent efforts to create a hiring algorithm for engineers. I used to use a thought experiment at this part of my talk with Fox News, where I would say, like, what if we used Fox News to, what if I was hired as a data scientist? I still do that. I still do data science. What if I was hired to build a hiring algorithm for Fox News? And then I would just remind you guys that you know how to build algorithms. You just need historical data and a definition of success, right? The most obvious choice of historical data is anybody who's ever applied to Fox News. 22 years of data. Some of them got the offer. Some of them came. Some of them were successful. And we would like to predict who's going to be successful, because that's the kind of person we want to hire, right? And then I would say, well, what do you mean by success in a corporate setting, whether it's Fox News or Amazon? What do you mean by success? What's a normal, generic definition of success? And I typically get the audience to say something like, you stay for a long time, you get promoted, you get raises. Generic. Reason I'm emphasizing that is because I took a reasonable choice of data and I took a reasonable choice of definition of success. But now you add that women were systematically and people of color were systematically prevented from being successful at Fox News. And when you train an algorithm to look for patterns of success or failure, what happens is when you then apply that algorithm to a current pool of applicants, it will actually filter out qualified women and qualified people of color. Because it'll say to itself, doesn't really talk to itself, but you know what I mean. The algorithm will say, that qualified woman does not look like somebody who was successful in the past. That's bias data. That is probably kind of the quintessential bias when we think about bias in algorithms. It's called garbage in, garbage out. It's the actual data that's saying people like you didn't get raises, you didn't get promoted, you didn't stay very long for some reason, therefore we will not hire you. That is biased data set. Anyway, the point is it used to be a thought experiment. Now it happened. Amazon did exactly this, I assume with almost exactly those choices, data they had in their cupboard, a sort of generic definition of success, and they found, guess what, it was sexist. They found that women's colleges like Barnard, which is where I used to be a professor, would give you negative points. The word executed, for some reason, men use that word more in their resume than women, would give you plus points. I think it was that example where the word Jared would give you plus points, just for being called Jared, or having a Jared on your resume. And to be clear, it didn't actually say female, male, right? That's not how this data science works. If there is one way of describing what data science does, or big data techniques, is it infers. It repurposes data using proxies. And it infers your gender, not explicitly even. And the reason I say that is because it's important to realize that the people building this stuff, the way they look at it is, I took a reasonable definition of data. I took a reasonable definition of success. I didn't make it sexist, but it ends up being sexist. And I should applaud Amazon for checking, because most hiring algorithms, as far as I know, have not been checked and probably are all sexist and, for that matter, racist. We have a different kind of bias in the world of predictive policing, which is that we don't have all the data. It's a missing data problem. It's a different kind of bias than a biased data. Theoretically, Amazon could adjust their data. They could say, to what extent, how many points off do women's colleges get? We'll put those points back on. They could account for the bias. What you cannot do is create data that doesn't exist. Well, you could probably account for it in a certain way too, but we haven't done that yet. We could talk about that later. What we have is a system where we call something crime data, but what it really is arrest data. And there's a huge discrepancy between those two things. Just to give you three examples, most murders, well, a very small, a little bit more than 50% of murders lead to an arrest. So that's when you have a definitive crime. You know someone killed somebody, but you only lead to an arrest about 56% of the time, and less than 50% of the time if the victim is black. Second example, rape. We don't really know how many rapes are reported, probably less than 20%. When rapes are reported, 6% of reported rapes lead to arrest. So if you want to compare the set of rapes to the set of arrests around rapes, you're going to have to realize that this is much smaller than this. And yet we call it crime data. We call this crime data. The final example is with smoking pot. And that's where you have the best ground truth, by which I mean you actually know what the truth is. And that's because people are willing to say they smoke pot. And what you see there is that whites and blacks smoke pot at the same rate, but blacks get arrested 4 or 5 times more than whites in specific areas, of course, where they live. And that's really what comes down to with predictive policing, is that we used to have broken windows policing, which was clearly racist. We decided we're not doing that anymore. We replaced it with a scientific process which continues the same exact policy. Because what it does is it says, where were the arrests, we will send cops over there. So wherever there were arrests, we will send more cops there. That propagates that cycle. Another way of saying it is, if we had sent, after the crisis, because I am an occupier, so I'm by contract required to say something like this, if we had sent the cops to Wall Street to arrest the bankers after the crisis, then the data would say, the algorithm would say, go back to Wall Street, that's where the criminals are. But we didn't do that. Downstream from predictive policing, we have crime risk scores, which has a questionnaire similar to the personality test I was talking about earlier, but the questionnaire, which are almost entirely proxies of race, class, addiction status, mental health status, and other things that you can see are highly correlated to either being profiled by the police or to be getting arrested in the future, because we criminalize poverty and we criminalize addiction. So in other words, this algorithm, which is, to be fair, predicting the probability of somebody getting rearrested within 2 years of leaving prison, that is the definition of these crime risk scores, they're not that inaccurate. They ask questions basically saying, are you someone who will be profiled by the police in the future? Are you someone who will get arrested for being untreated mental health, having an untreated mental health problem or having an addiction problem? And if you think about it that way, you're not going to be surprised by the kinds of questions you get asked on that. Never ask you, what, are you black or brown? But it does ask, did you get suspended in high school, which is a proxy for race. I haven't had enough time, and I'm almost done with my talk, to talk about how this isn't just destructive on the individual level, but all these examples are not just destructive on the individual level. They're destructive on the society level. And what I mean by that is, think about this. You're given a higher crime risk score, not because of your inherent criminality, which these things aren't measuring, but by your sort of profileability in the future that leads to a longer sentence. I forgot to mention that if you get a higher risk score, if you're deemed higher risk of being rearrested, you were sentenced to longer on average. You don't get rehabilitated in prison. Instead, you end up out of prison with fewer resources and fewer job prospects, fewer ties to your community, and you end up back in prison. Now, how diabolical is this feedback loop? It's bad because it creates its own reality. But it's even worse than that, because when I challenge the data scientists who are working on this stuff on how their models are being used, they said that they had no responsibility for it and they were just going with accuracy, which is the only thing that they got rewarded on. But to be clear, if you are creating this reality whereby higher risk scores lead to people going back to prison, you're doing a good job. That is improving your accuracy rates. What I'm trying to say is that the incentives underlying a data scientist's job are directly anti-social, right? They're actually getting you, you're getting rewarded for getting people back into the prison pipeline. I don't even have time, thank God, to talk about the last most complicated and probably unsolvable problem of our age, which is social media algorithms. When I say unsolvable, I now audit algorithms. So for a living, I go into companies and try to help them make their algorithms less terrible. I've already said to everyone that I've talked to about this that I would never work for Facebook because they cannot fix the problems that they have created. We do not have a model for truth. AI does not have a model for truth. If you ever talk to AI specialists, they will constantly try to talk to you about chess and Go, because those are the two examples where we know what it means to win. But this question of win for whom, and what do you, if you think that means win, I don't think that means win. If you have different stakeholders with different definitions of winning and losing, it gets really complicated really fast. And in the world of social media, it's infinitely complicated. And there is no definition of misinformation. So how can you even consider that as an AI problem? You can't. And anytime Zuckerberg goes to Congress and says he's going to solve that problem with AI, he is lying. I want there to be solutions to this. I actually do have a lot of hope. I spent this morning at the facial recognition congressional hearing, and I was really pleased to see not solutions, but at least a recognition of the problems that we are seeing proliferate around us. And that starts with not assuming that algorithms are inherently perfect and fair. And then we can talk about what it means, and this what the white paper does so well, is talk about what it means. Now that we know that these algorithms aren't inherently fair, what are we going to do about it? And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay. Woo! That was interesting, right? Because you've actually laid out for us, and I know the audience may have questions, so I just have a couple of questions that I want to ask her, and then I'm going to open it up to audience Q&A. So you shared a lot, right? And you shared, I think, a lot about how algorithms are being embedded in society. And I'd like to ask you a question in terms of, what do you predict will be the further diffusion of these algorithms in our everyday life? You mentioned a few use cases where we should have cause for concern, but, you know, they're all over the place. I mean, I pretty much have good birthday days with my kids because I don't have to leave my house. And so there are less, you know, harmful ways that we're seeing it. But I'm just curious what you think is going to be the future of the algorithmic economy.
I mean, if I'm in a good mood or in a bad mood.
Which one? I hope you're in a good mood today. You're at Brookings. Can we give her a hand or something? You know, that you would welcome her at Brookings. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look. There's a lot of really, and I build algorithms for a living, right? So I haven't turned off my hope. In on a good day, I think to myself, you know, going back to the Amazon example, like Amazon saw that it was a sexist hiring algorithm. They decided not to use it, and I'm glad they're not using a flawed algorithm. But you know what they could have done is they could have said, oh, this is a codified version of our human process that's called the hiring process, and it's sexist. Maybe our human process is sexist. Maybe we should fix that. And I'm not saying they haven't done that. I don't know what they're doing. But my point is that in some sense, you could think of algorithms as tools that help us improve ourselves. They, instead, we could take up any process, we could codify it, and we could say, okay, now that we have this sort of automated version of that process, what are its problems? And how can we reflect back to that original process and make it better? Like, in other words, we could think of it as a tool. For that matter, the crime risk scores, I think of that as like an opportunity. It doesn't have to be, let's punish people who are already screwed, which is what it is right now. Let's punish people who are already unlucky enough to be in the wrong demographic. It could be a tool by which we say, what does this say about us that people with mental health problems are so much more likely to be arrested? How can we close the disparity? So, I mean, in my best days, I think this could be a tool that could be really useful if we ever decided to do it to help each other rather than to punish each other.
Right. Well, and I think also, I mean, some of the research that we placed in the paper and some research that I do as a sociologist, I think we also have to embrace our biases internally, right? And so you create things based on your own implicit and unconscious biases, and those drive the design. So perhaps on that planning team at Amazon, there were not enough women who could actually flag what those disparities may actually be. And I think that's something that is you brought up in your conversation that I'd like to actually just delve right into. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we seeing enough diversity in these spaces that are creating, building, and diffusing much of what we're relying upon today for these predictions and outputs?
I mean, you've put your finger on it. Like, we absolutely do not have enough diversity. Having a company that goes in and helps people make algorithms better, I know for a fact that I'm much more likely to be hired by a company whose team is diverse. Those are the ones that are like, I don't care if there's some legal vulnerability that we're introducing. We want to do the right thing. Because that is always the push and pull with this. It's like kind of a plausible deniability that they're getting rid of in order to fix a problem that they're not even sure they have. So there's that push and pull, and diverse teams make better teams for those exactly these reasons. And I'll say one caveat to that. And the caveat is there's all sorts of differences that probably will never all be represented on a technology team. And I will specifically mention people that are uneducated. You know, people that have less privilege to education itself. And poor people. They're just not in Silicon Valley tech teams. And that kind of diversity, I don't see happening. So the question for me is, like, can we build a paradigm where diversity in various ways is accounted for, even if it's not specifically represented? You know, disability, you know, all like, ageism. There's all sorts of kinds of discrimination that we should be taking into account that's probably not going to be represented specifically on our team. So how do we figure out how to deal with it?
Yeah, we call in the paper a concept that is near and dear to my heart, diversity in design, mm-hmm. and creative inclusive environments where we're actually building algorithms that take into account all those things. You even need sociologists on your team.
Because yes, you do.
You look at the criminal justice algorithm. A sociologist can tell you, because that was part of Sociology 101, that the rate of imprisonment and the rate of arrest happens more predominantly in African-American communities. So if you're training an algorithm off that data, the most people that are going to pop up are going to be African-American men. So that's not a good data source because our history we cannot run away from as a country.
Right.
I would also suggest then something that you said about this whole idea of the timeliness in bringing algorithms to market. I would say as an academic, we have IRB requirements where we have to actually assess the human subject before we can actually take that research to a community. It seems in the data science space, it's a rush to market.
Yeah.
That, you know, compiling as much as you can is all about getting to market first. And I guess I would ask you, what's the opportunity and where are the dangers in doing that? And are these mismatches that exist between the social science and scientific community, will they get wider as a result? And we'll see a lot of these unintended consequences you discussed. I gave you a lot, but I expect you to answer it all, okay?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, at the facial recognition hearing this morning, we heard people from both sides talking about the horses out of the barn. Like, how did it happen so quickly? I think about it as like, these tools have gotten really cheap. Sensors have gotten cheap. Data collection, data storage, everything has gotten so cheap that our tools are suddenly pretty much free. And then the question becomes, how can we build a business model around this? There are no rules. There's literally no regulation, really, around facial recognition, but for most of these data collection things. There's like specific regulation for medical data for children, or you know, a couple other things. But that's not how we work, and it's not how we work because we want to encourage innovation. That all makes sense. What is problematic, and what's so great about your white paper and being here today, is that there's pretty much no push against the lobbyist story about this, about innovation. In fact, I cried today during the congressional hearing because when I was doing research for my book, I went to a congressional subcommittee hearing on big data analytics, and every single person talking to congressmen had a vested interest, was basically a lobbyist. And they were telling these cherry-picked stories about premature babies getting their lives being saved through big data. And there was never a discussion about what could go wrong. And today I saw the opposite, and it was just like, thank God, there's like pushback here. We need some reality to sort of enter into this mainstream discussion. I'm glad to see it.
Yeah, and I guess on that, and then I'm going to open it up for questions in a few minutes. I'm just indulging myself. But do you think that there's a balance that we need to actually have when it comes to the rush to regulation, right? Because like you said, and particularly Joy's work on facial recognition, we just don't know enough about the technology at this point.
Absolutely.
Or we don't have enough diversity in the profession.
Yeah.
Or we haven't really applied this to a variety of use cases. Where's the balance, particularly for policymakers right now who have like the big question mark over their head trying to figure out what to do?
I have really specific advice. Mm-hmm. And my advice is, first of all, triage. Mm-hmm. Care much more about potential weapons of mass destruction than the average algorithm. Who cares about the average algorithm? Most people don't, I don't. Care about ones that are choosing who gets financial benefit, credit cards, insurance, a job, mm-hmm. housing. That kind of financial, again, liberty or livelihood. Focus on important algorithms first. And then second of all, don't come up with a rule system yet. Ask for evidence. And this is one of the most obvious things. And it's like, sometimes I just say it's putting science into data science.
Right.
Like, science is verifiable. It is hypothesis tested. It has evidence. And when you tell me this works, I would like you to tell me what you mean by that. What do you mean this works? Works for whom? For whom does it fail? So the questions around like Joy's work were like, it works for white men, but not for black women. I just want to pull my hair out because I'm like, IBM, Microsoft, and Amazon, how did you not think to ask that question? And do you really need congressmen and senators to say, please ask that question? Come on. Basic questions of like, show me the evidence that it works for obvious groups of people. It's kind of common sense.
Yeah, and that's something, again, I'm so glad that Kathy has plugged our paper. We're going to talk about that in just a moment, but I so agree with you that there has to be this triage of one, understanding what use cases, a triage within companies and across companies and across disciplines is, I think, what you've actually shed light upon. And I think just more conversation on this, right? There's been a lot you've learned since you wrote your book, girl, right? The algorithms have come and left the station, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm sure when you wrote the book, we weren't anywhere near where we are today.
I had to do this today.
Oh, we yeah, you hear that? That's what we do. We make dreams come true. I'm just saying. Okay, with that being said, and it was a dream to do this paper, and I'll talk about it in just a moment. We have time for just a couple of questions, one or two questions, and then we've got to move on to the next part. And I'll ask that you save it, the commentary, and get right to the questions so that we can be very useful of our time. Okay, so let's take this young lady right here.
I can remember walking out of quantitative
presentation. You got it? You want to use mine? Here, use mine for right now.
I can remember walking out of quantitative presentations when I was at the University of Michigan in education, wondering what happened to the children. There seemed to be no human element in that. And that's my concern about, I read your book, and especially in terms of hiring, I can't see under any circumstances where abandoning the human element is going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, hiring scares me a lot. I would say, because I've been, in sort of off-the-record discussions with tons of people involved in the hiring ecosystem on the internet. Like, people get jobs on the internet now, and guess what? The match is it not Match? It's monsters.coms of the world. They don't do careful science. I mean, I don't want to single them out. It's every single ecosystem that hires, that Match makes between job seekers and employers. They're like, people like you got jobs like this. You know what that does? It means like white guys get STEM jobs and brown women get daycare jobs. Let's be real. That's what hiring is. It's become a sort of mechanized, codified perpetuation of all the biases in our society. And I know facial recognition is a sexy thing, and I'm glad we had a hearing about it, yeah. But like hiring is a hornet's nest.
Small quarter of all the AI applications.
And it has taken the people out of it entirely. And just going back to the example of Kyle, he didn't get the job. He didn't get any of those seven jobs. He didn't get any of those hundreds of jobs because they're all big box stores. In the past, I mean, he might not have gotten a job from some hiring guy who was a jerk because he didn't like the way that cut of his nib. But like, the point is, cut of the jib. The point is that like, there would be a lot of different people he could try. And now it's scaled up to such an extent that the human element is completely out of it. You're right.
So I'm going to have to be a bad cop in a minute because I want to keep us on time. So I'm going to choose one question from this section, and then we'll obviously have Q&A after the panel discussion. So I'm not going to say who. We'll be fair. We'll do this guy at the end just because we did a woman, and then we'll come back. But please write your questions down. If we have time at the end of the panel discussion, I'm sure Daryl will entertain more questions.
In the spirit of asking if the converse holds, so you may know that in the new judicial branch, there's sort of a long documented allergy to mathematical reasoning of any kind. Like going back to the 80s with McCleskey v. Kemp, recently John Roberts used the phrase sociological gobbledygook to describe the efficiency gap, which is, I also think, a relatively vanilla way of algorithmically describing something. And all of these are attempts of people to use mathematics to quantify where injustice exists and address it. And so I kind of want to ask about the opposite problem, that of essentially what I would characterize as just anti-intelligentsia sentiment in the halls of power, preventing a careful, reasoned mathematical analysis of injustice and what you think about that problem.
Well, I would say that we're not doing ourselves any favors, us mathematicians, by doing stuff and like calling it math and then it being untrustworthy. I mean, I'm with you. Like, if we could use like, you know, statistically sound concepts to understand gerrymandering, which is, I think, what you were referring to, great. I mean, I'm speaking as somebody who's a communicator at this point, and I would say, like, you don't just call it something. You have to draw a picture and show why it is a statistical anomaly. That's how you actually explain things to people. But my point is, like, I would love to be able to use that kind of thing well, in an open way where people get to disagree with me and we could have these public debates about it, for that matter. But the first step is for us not to lie and just to say, this is math, this is science. Or not allow the marketers of this AI crap to lie on our behalf. So we have to stand up and say, no, that's not math, that's not science.
Okay, I've got to be the bearer of bad news because I want to move on to the panel, but I want you to parking lot your questions because I want to give us enough time to actually move through the next part of the discussion, which I think complements what Kathy has actually presented. Let's give Kathy a big round of applause for her participation today.
Do I sit over there?
And again, I know you have numerous questions. I'm not sure if she's going to run right out, but I know she's going to chill out. She'll be here. Okay, perfect. So I'm going to turn this off and go here. Uh-oh, I did something wrong with the slides because I hit the off button. So I want to switch a little bit over to then what we did then at Brookings to sort of complement, I think, what you heard today. And what we did, thank you, because, you know, I just turned it off. What we did at Brookings was to think about the questions that Kathy O'Neill and others have actually presented and tried to figure out a way to have a conversation that would provide some constructive dialogue as well as some guardrails around how do you look at algorithmic bias. This is a topic, as a sociologist, bias in general and systematic discrimination is very important to me as an individual in social justice. But it was a conversation that actually started with Jeannie Burton and myself sitting in a room
having a cup of coffee, talking about actually privacy, which is another hot topic, and trying to figure out how do you take this conversation on privacy and really apply that to what we're seeing in the world of artificial intelligence and how computers are now making predictions and outputs about our life. And I think one of the things to do, if you've not already seen this, is define what we think of as algorithms. When we met Paul, you know, here you have, again, a sociologist and a lawyer who were trying to understand the world of science from the social cost perspective and what the legal ramifications were of those social costs. And then we met Paul, who's a computer scientist, and said, hey, there are a variety of applications of algorithms, and let's come up with a universal definition for what we could use to sort of explain to both policymakers, civil society, and industry leaders how they can deploy best practices. So this is the definition that we essentially use that is in the paper in terms of looking at how Kathy described it, algorithms as a set of instructions to perform a task. And that's very much embedded in the cognitive intelligence of computers today and what they actually do when they have access to massive data sets to make those computational decisions. What's interesting about this paper is that we didn't stop there in terms of methodology between the three of us. We actually put together two series of roundtable discussions. It was really important for us to hear from other stakeholders who are either in the business, who are affected by the business, or who have an understanding of the business. Those were academics, they were industry leaders, and they were civil society groups. And over the course of a year, we did a roundtable here in Washington, D.C., and we did one in San Francisco. And you'll see in the paper the list of participants who so kindly allowed us to use their names to understand the scope and the breadth of the knowledge that we gained. There was a lot of knowledge and a lot of experts in both of those panel discussions who were able to, I guess, unlock the black box and help us contribute towards white box thinking in this world of this algorithmic economy. And I just want to reiterate what Kathy mentioned. There are multiple use cases for data science and machine learning. So when it's an algorithm, as Paul has educated me, it's a set of instructions. When it's actually applied to machine learning, it's a set of repetitive instructions that has the ability to make highly efficient and effective decisions that are a result of what those repetitive functions are. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a discussion of how we actually define that. That's machine learning. That's what allows you to get a recommendation of a movie after you've watched 10, where the computer can come back and say, hey, you like romance movies? I'm going to give you another one. That can also allow you to get recommendations for purchases. It can recommend you for your potential partner or spouse. And it can also do, I think, what Kathy has mentioned. It can give you a longer prison sentence. It can kick you out of being creditworthy for a loan. It can make this judgment or assessment that you are not suitable for employment and do other things that have what we call disparate impacts, particularly on protected groups. And so the focus of our research, and I'm very mindful of the wonderful research that has come out of the policy community in this area, is really around focusing on a bias and how bias actually goes to the concerns of protected groups. In the paper, we define bias when the model generates a systematically unfavorable result for a particular group of people. And in our case, it's not just an individual result, it's a collective set of results that tend to place people in a bucket. So I'll give you a perfect example of my experience. I've been doing this for a long time. I saw Kathy 5 years ago when the FTC talked about this. I was on a panel years before that. I was just about a month ago on a panel, on a hearing on diversity in the tech sector. And I sat up there with a few other scholars. And the multiple examples in which I heard were, you know, the search queries that return results of African Americans as primates, results that show certain populations of people, when you put in, this happened a couple years ago, when you put in a search result for happy teenagers, you got mugshots for African Americans, you got smiling pictures for white students. And I was sitting up on this panel just a month ago, and I said to myself, why is this still happening? And so with the co-authors, the focus of this research is to help all of us understand why this is happening. And this is just the beginning. This is to provide some framing for how do we get there. And it's also an exercise that we thought as part of the paper to bring people from distinct disciplines who have very different realities of these situations to come up with a coherent, piece that can be both pragmatic as well as exceptional in the discussions around policy. Right now, there are probably about 5 to 10 bills on the Hill around artificial intelligence, some of which include algorithmic bias. There are conversations at universities in which task force have been convened, some of them representative, some of them not. There are industry who are reaching out and looking for answers with regards to how to solve it. But there's this imperfection that is sort of still going to be unperfected until we have these conversations. And I want to be mindful, I see Ayaz there too. At the time, Jeannie worked for the Better Business Bureau, which made it a nice match for why we wanted to do this. And so a lot of the thinking, again, was to come up with a paper that could be used by a big company and a small company, a startup and a non-startup, to provide those guardrails. So I say that because the paper is long, so it's going to take some reading. It is a research paper, not a blog. And it's organized to actually appeal to the fancies of technologists, industry leaders, as well as the diffusers of algorithms, any company that licenses and distributes. We are really happy in our roundtables that we not only had big tech companies like a Facebook, but we also had companies like MasterCard and Walmart and other people who are trying to distribute those algorithms. And so it was a very full conversation. Every time we left, I think our cup runneth over with more knowledge around the state. So before I bring up the panel and my boss to actually moderate the discussion, I wanted to just leave you with a couple of tidbits of the recommendations that we actually had. And I actually don't have a slide for that because I didn't want to give you too much because I want you to read the paper and not get the cliff notes. So I decided not to do that. Plus, I'm with my co-authors and I want to make sure that we have a time to discuss this. So what did we say? When you look at issues of bias in online recruitment, word associations, facial recognition, the list goes on. What makes sense to us is to come up with a series of self-regulatory proposals. What can industry do by themselves? I think the comment that Kathy made in terms of Amazon taking down their recruitment algorithm was industry action before Congress had to legislate. We've come up with a series of public policy recommendations as well. Less prescriptive, but much more meaningful in terms of what policymakers can do as the innovation develops, and then some civil society actions with the hopes of if you bring those together, you're not going to have a perfect world, but you're actually going to get close. Some of those recommendations as I close include the clarification of the non-discrimination laws that have put in effect in the 60s to make it clear that you cannot create algorithms that restrict people from housing and employment opportunities. There's a wonderful woman I met. We're going to have a series of panels on this from New York who uses the EEOC guidelines in the development of their algorithms to ensure that they are lawful. A bias impact statement, which allows industry as a self-regulatory model, and we have the questions to say, why am I automating this? Who is at the table? Who is not at the table? What are the intended and unintended consequences? Is there diversity in design? Is there a feedback loop that is actually part of the process for us to understand when it is not curating the right results? Audits, which is actually something that has become industry approved and used as sort of a gold star practice. Regulatory sandboxes. As Kathy mentioned, one of the proposals that we'll put in, and we talk about it in our discussion, companies that are online, particularly tech companies, cannot collect demographic information. They can only infer, as my friend Chris Wood here would say, somebody that he's not, just by the things that they see you do. Well, if you cannot always use those online proxies, what happens when you want to do anti-bias experimentation? What happens when you don't want to put out algorithms that actually can discriminate? Well, maybe a regulatory sandbox may be the answer, or some type of safe harbor, particularly when you're not trying to do harm. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. And then one last thing on the civil society approach that we thought, we've got to do more algorithmic literacy. We live in a world today, and I'll close here, and Kathy asked a really great question, so I'm also going to plug my book, where people have become digitally invisible physically because they're not part of the digital revolution, and they become digitally invisible intuitively and behaviorally because algorithms are like an ocean. The deeper you go, you can't see the bottom. And when you as a consumer don't understand why you're being served and delivered these outputs or outcomes, you run the risk of being subjected to the type of discriminatory effects that we talk about in the paper. And so we think going forward that there's this role that consumers are something that needs to happen. Years ago, I've been in this industry about 20 years working on research. Years ago, we called it digital education. Was that it, Daryl? Like every kid should have it, like a civic education. We tried. Then we said, okay, every kid should know what to do online when they turn the computer on. We tried. And today, with digital becoming so much more intuitive and digital economy making about 6.2% of the GDP, maybe algorithmic literacy is the next conversation. What are the inferences being made about me, and what's the ability, what ability do I have to recurate that if it's not right? And so with that, I'd say read the paper. It's online. We're really excited about doing it. It was a very long process, but I think very much worth it for all of the stakeholders that we are actually talking to. And I want to turn it over to, like I said, my next favorite person. I actually felt bad saying next because he's my favorite all the time because he writes my checks, but which is Daryl West, who is the VP of the Governance Studies Department here at Brookings and the director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He will lead the panel of myself and my co-authors. So come on up, Daryl.
So I'd say that is quite an invocation there. Read the paper. I actually recommend the paper as well. It's a good read on a very important topic. I want to thank Kathy for her presentation, kind of highlighting some of the issues of algorithms, how we need to overcome some of the biases that already have been documented. I like your term algorithmic decency as a goal to which we should aspire, and the fact that we definitely need more diversity among the software teams that are developing these things. The paper that Nicole, Paul, and Jeannie presented is a novel paper in a lot of different respects, in the sense that it tries to outline how we go about detecting biases. So that's certainly a very important contribution. And they're actually more nuanced, I believe, in how they think about that topic than many other things that I have read, so recommended on that basis. But then secondly, they also spend a lot of time thinking about ways to mitigate those kinds of biases. They talk about best practices, policy changes that we're going to need to make. We'll get into some of their recommendations in terms of the bias impact statements, regulatory sandboxes and safe harbors, the need for AI audits, and the need also for people to develop greater AI literacy. So Nicole, you have heard from. She's a fellow in our Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings. Paul Resnick is a professor of information and also associate dean for research and faculty affairs at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. And Jeannie Barton, formerly of the Better Business Bureau, is a member of the Research Advisory Board of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. So I want to start out first with Nicole, a question just in terms of the background on the paper. One of the things that's unusual about this paper is it combines the views of a sociologist, an engineer, and a lawyer. So how did this project evolve, and what role did each of you play, given your respective expertises?
Yeah, I keep wanting to go back. There was this 80s song in New York. I can't remember. It was like part of a disco. It's like, when you put together three different people, and what do you have? It's a big party, right? It was a hard party, having a sociologist, a computer scientist, and a lawyer all in the same room. I mean, it's hard to be a sociologist with a lawyer, and then you add somebody with a science background, and you might as well forget it. But it was a good process because we all have a different perspective. We were all trained differently in how we look at things. We all had different understandings of the outputs in terms of social costs versus scientific inquiry. And I think it's an exercise that I have found was very helpful to sort of break through my bubble of how I look at things as a policymaker. Policymakers, we tend to rush for judgment. You know, we want to get out there first, much like data scientists do when it comes to products and services. But it allowed us to sort of step back and do more what I call white box thinking. where we can uncover some of the truths, as Kathy mentioned, where we either had drawback, you know, fallbacks, or where there were opportunities. So I'm not going to lie, though, it was hard. And, you know, you put three type A people on the same paper, it just makes co-authoring a little more difficult. But when we got through the process, I think, and hopefully my colleagues agree, that I think we were able to put something together that policymakers of diverse audiences could read. Because as those of you, not to say this, who work in Washington know, the attention span of a policymaker is very limited because we are always on issues. And so, you know, that's what made the experience very interesting, too, to be able to bring it together.
I feel like we should actually interview each of them.
So right.
But Jeannie and Paul, I want to get your thoughts on the experience and how it went from your standpoint.
Well, the first thing I have to say, because it's let's shoot all the lawyers, which is a misquotation of Shakespeare, is I started out as a Shakespeare scholar.
And you say that as an attorney.
I say that as an attorney. But I think the important thing was that we all are necessary. All our viewpoints need to be considered by policymakers, by industry people, by anyone who's working on these issues, because they are ethical issues, they are computer science issues, they are sociology issues, and they are policy issues. They are also something that Shakespeare was in his time, and that is revolutionary. We are seeing a huge sea change. We don't understand it. I can't think of anyone who is better at explaining the drawbacks than Kathy was. We trust pseudoscience at times, or science that is not informed by these other disciplines. And to get it right in a society that needs us to be mindful of human dignity, of economic inequalities, of the many, many things that are being decided more by machines, we have to take these three, we have to take all of you, we have to go on the Hill where Kathy was, we have to go to regulatory agencies. But first we have to understand before we regulate.
So Paul, you brought the most technical expertise to this project. What was your perspective?
I guess I'm the guilty one of always saying let's slow down. I'm just reminded of one of the earliest mentoring advice I got from a senior faculty member when I was just starting out, Michael Cohen. Not that Michael Cohen. he said, Paul, our job as professors is when people think things are simple, we have to make it complicated for them. And when they think it's complicated, we have to make it simple for them. So I hope I've done a little bit of both of that.
Okay. Jeannie, so we've heard Kathy's views of some of the issues raised by algorithms. What do you think are the critical questions that need to be raised about AI, and why is it important to understand the function of these algorithms in the emerging economy?
I can only echo and add a little bit to what Kathy said. And I will say that when I started out doing this, as president of the Better Business Bureau Institute for Marketplace Trust, the question of trust was central to what I thought was important, and appropriate trust. And I had discovered that we didn't understand very well what algorithms were doing. We didn't know how to evaluate them. And I had seen as self-regulator of behavioral advertising, that there were some troubling issues that could not be addressed just by privacy. Nicole and I go all the way back to the FCC. And so we got together, and I think the most important thing to me was that we understood the problems and were able to communicate them in ways that policymakers could understand. And I totally agree with the idea that we have to focus on the algorithms that really affect human beings. It's okay if we make a mistake about whether you want red shoes. Okay. It is not okay when we make a mistake about whether you get a job or a loan.
And that is not to say that algorithms aren't helping certain people who would not get a job, would not get a loan, to be empowered. But the dangers, the error rates matter. And that's what I think we need to do.
So, Paul, in the paper, you mention a series, you and your co-authors mention a series of technical challenges and trade-offs when it comes to the design of algorithms. So can you go into a little greater detail on what those technical challenges are?
Yeah, I mean, Kathy's already done that for us a little bit, so I'll just remind us of several things that she mentioned, then I'll add one more. So in these algorithms, we're using the past to predict the future, or we're using some training data to predict things about items that were not in the training data. And three things can, or sort of, you can, it's sort of obvious how thing, three things that are going to go wrong are. One is that if we start in our training data with things where we have mislabeled them, where the training data says the outcome was one thing, but the outcome really wasn't that. It says that somebody in our training data, it says they weren't a good employee, but actually they were a good employee, and we just had a biased system. So that's a problem because we're just going to reproduce those biases if we had the outcomes wrong in our training data. The second problem is that our training data may be non-representative. We just may never have seen somebody like this before, and we're going to try to treat them as if they were like something that we have seen before, but we haven't. And so we're going to get errors that way. And the third is feedback loops that we don't recognize, or that we use the next data that was influenced by our algorithms to act as additional training data for improving or maybe making worse the algorithms. So the one that I want to bring up in addition is that, and I think this came up repeatedly in our roundtables, is that there's sort of a naive hope that if we blind ourselves to the attributes that are protected, if we never code in our data that somebody's female or they're African American or they have a mental health disability, if we never code that, then we won't be biased. And, you know, I've talked to people at companies who say, I'm restricted from using that data. Our company has a company-wide policy that we will not collect that data, we won't use that data, and that's to protect ourselves from doing the wrong thing. And it doesn't protect from doing the wrong thing. It's not sufficient, and it actually gets in the way if you're trying to do the right thing and you want to do some kind of audits to see how well you're doing, but you're not allowed to check how well you're doing. So that's one thing that, you know, sort of struck me as really important, and that we need to move beyond that idea that if we're blind to race, we'll be fair on race.
So, Nicole, Paul just mentioned your roundtables, and the paper goes into a little greater detail on those as well. Why are the algorithms becoming such a cause for concern? And then especially, how do we think policymakers and people in civil society should be thinking about some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we did the roundtables, and again, these were a mix of people that were in both, you know, whether from civil society groups or industry, or they were technologists or academics, or whatever the case may be, there was an overwhelming agreement that we should not actually have algorithms replicate or amplify the stereotypes that we have today. But it already happened. Right. And a lot of that has to do with the data in, you know, garbage in, garbage out, whether or not you're sensitized to these online proxies that may not say it's race, but they use zip code, et cetera. And so I think the roundtables, the cause for concern, I think all of it you've heard today are in those areas where we've already seen discrimination act its out, that the technology overlays that and expands it and makes it worse. Because now you have sort of a quiet violator that you cannot necessarily take to the Supreme Court to say, hey, you know, this employment algorithm just stopped me from getting a job, because there's a lot that's opaque about what people know about it. And so I think going forward, I think where we landed up with the paper was then, what are those use cases? And so we give some examples where a lot of discussion goes into it. But there are also use cases that are not part of the cork board
that are, you know, equally dangerous. And I think those are ones that, you know, we not, may not pay attention to when it comes to, there's an example in the paper. We may talk about the underrepresentation of data when it comes to the use of facial recognition, but we never talk about the overrepresentation of data when we look at things like mass surveillance and the fact that there are more black faces in many of these police databases than there are white faces. So they are have a likelihood of being overly scrutinized when it comes to the algorithm. And so part of our discussion, again, was, you know, or another one I'd like to add in, we may talk about the discrete variables of race, but we don't sort of intersect that with sexual orientation or other variables that also create some type of harm. And so, you know, it was a hard way to sort of disentangle those, Daryl, but the roundtable participants, because they were either doers as creators or they were distributing it, and these were some people who were like chief privacy officers that didn't sit in the same room with the designer. There are ethical implications if you're not really thinking about the fairness quotient when you're actually developing these. And when you don't have the right person in the room, we continuously heard that. When the right people are not in the room that have an understanding about these issues, you run the risk of either some kind of legal harm because someone may come back and sue you. You run the risk of actually having the opportunity of getting somebody like Kathy to come audit your algorithms, right? Because you have no idea. But as Jeannie said, you want to stay in the know of the trust of your consumers. And that's where I think, Daryl, we heard a lot of that. You know, there are always going to be costs and that are going to be associated with, there's going to be threats. But how do you maintain some type of certainty that you could still be trustworthy in what you're doing? And so that's, I think, where we landed up and why, again, it's a hard conversation to have, particularly if you look at populations that are disproportionately discriminated against already. When you overlay technology, you know, what that looks like becomes even more daunting.
So, Jeannie, I want to ask you the $64,000 governance question of who should decide. So when it comes to ethical frameworks and some of these fairness concerns, like who should be the arbiter? Government, industry, some other entity?
I would say all of the above and none of the above. And what I mean by that is that one of the lessons that I learned really well and I'm very grateful for in this paper is I learned the slippery nature of fairness. And I read painfully statistical analyses of some of the controversial algorithms, whether they were fair, whether they were biased. And one thing that I learned was that there are very different measures of parity depending on what you're looking at. And so to determine what is fair, it isn't a fair burden on a computer scientist. A government official, if the government official doesn't understand that, then they can't make the judgment. Equally, the legal system can't make the judment, industry can't.
Jump in and add there. One reason it's not a fair burden to put on computer scientists is that you can't have it all theorem.
That's right.
There's a theorem
that says
we have these different notions of fairness, and you can't simultaneously satisfy all of them to make them all true at the same time.
Right.
And so we're going to have some guidance about in which situations do you care about which of these measures of fairness.
So here, Daryl, so we can kind of replicate what we went through in our process.
I've lost control of the panel already. Which is okay.
This was the three of us. Go ahead. But he's explaining it. I'm learning it. I'm saying, wait, how are we going to say this is ethical? What?
Well, I was just going to say over Paul's point, because this is actually a tricky issue for us, right? From a scientist's perspective, it's true. You know, I've learned this. You cannot say that everything is fair. You look at the COMPASS algorithm. The developer says it's fair based on their analysis. The people who are sort of scrutinized by it say it's unfair, you know, on the ProPublica report. But I guess for policymakers, there is this notion that fairness will become sort of the underlying assumption of how you actually do business, that you will consider the consumer costs. Consider and take that into account. And so I think that's an area where, you know, I think for all of us in this room and even policymakers who put in legislation, they struggle with that nuance of what Jeannie said. You know, how do you define fairness and what's fair to what group of people? And the unfortunate thing is if you don't have a productive guardrail or structure, the only people, and then Kathy put it, the only people suffering are the people who are the object of the algorithm.
That's right.
Because the object of the algorithm is taking your moral compass to determine fairness. And in that case, it could determine a product or service that doesn't go to their community. It could determine, as Alex Rosenblatt from Data and Society, who writes about Uber, it could determine the rates that you're actually charged or you can be charged or the jobs that you're going to take. And so it's an interesting dynamic that I think we struggled with as well. So I'm sorry we had to throw it
in. No, it's really good because I was electrified when I recognized how much historical bias and the data that goes into an algorithm, which is by its nature in many instances not free from historical or
thank me for that, Jeannie. Here you put me.
No, I thank wasn't with Saul and Baracus, but you certainly made sure that we were all mindful of it throughout the writing of the paper, and good for you. But when you have to know that, and you have to know the difficulty of assessing fairness and the damage if you don't. And those are the points, I think, that we were really trying to get across in the paper, and we were trying to do it in a way that was fair to computer scientists, fair to lawyers, fair to sociologists, and most of all, fair to consumers.
Yep.
And one thing I would like to add to that is in the non-digital world, you know, we now have worked out detailed rules, yeah. regulations, banks can do this, they can't do that. We've not applied a lot of those rules to the new digital economy. Okay. So I think part of the recommendation of your paper is we need to take some of the ways in which we actually have worked out these issues, but apply them to digital things. I want to get into some of the recommendations that you make, because you have a number of very important recommendations, bias impact statements, regulatory sandboxes, safe harbors, AI audits, improving AI literacy. So, Paul, maybe I'll start with you. The bias impact statement, so what is that, and why do you think that would help?
It's basically a set of questions that an internal team at a company or other organization can use to sort of ask themselves. You know, I think it's loosely inspired by environmental impact statements, or some organizations are doing privacy impact statements when they're introducing new product ideas. So it's sort of loosely in that realm, and it's a set of questions. You should ask these. Is this one of the important algorithms where if we were biased, it would really be hurting people's livelihood or their lives? How will we tell if we're biased? And so it's a whole series of questions. It's not very prescriptive about what all your answers should be. It doesn't say which metric of fairness you have to get equality on, but it says you ought to go through thinking about which one you are going to use to measure yourself by.
Nicole, can you tell us a little bit about how these bias impact statements would work?
Yeah, the bias impact statements, we see it as an industry leader or a government who's actually putting together or deploying an algorithm or civil society group, you would actually use the bias impact statement as your planning, right? And you would sit down and say, as Paul said, this is a decision that we want to automate. These are the people that we need to have involved in terms of the user incentives and the stakeholder groups. And this is, again, some of the technical and non-technical areas that we need to consider. And again, there are specific questions. We really wanted a pragmatic tool, because as you get on panels and people say, well, what do you do next? We thought we'd actually introduce a tool that could be used tomorrow for that matter. The goal of the bias impact statement is a self-regulatory management tool. Is if you're in a meeting with, and this is what we actually discovered in the roundtables and what you're seeing among us, if you're sitting with a diverse group or a cross-functional group of stakeholders who are investing in the algorithm, you're not just the data scientist, you know, sitting in a room by yourself, you may decide during the as part of the answers of these questions, this is not something we want to automate, or this is something that we need to take a little bit more time with, or perhaps we need to go a little bit under the hood to make sure that it doesn't go X. One gentleman from Microsoft, who was part of the roundtable, said, during this impact assessment, you might even consider, are there secondary or tertiary pockets of data that you might want to test this mm-hmm. against? So this was, again, for us, one of the areas that we gleaned was important to sort of move forward as a pragmatic tool that could be, you know, pretty much implemented without a policy intervention. It's really a discussion of, here's the tool. You know, we're still leaning towards a gray area. Let's kind of pull this back for a minute and see. Another area of the tool, does it break law? in terms of what we're doing with the algorithm. So as opposed to designing the algorithm without the law in mind, you design it with the law in mind, which allows you a better product. And so we're really proud of that, because in all of the papers that we had seen, we'd not seen this checklist. Good stuff on the auditing process, but we actually propose this as a pre-audit that then follows the algorithm through its life cycle, you know, where you get to the end and you're constantly asking yourself. Because the thing about algorithms, under the ocean, it changes based on what data it picks up. And so we thought that a lot of companies in particular in government may not look at how it changes and evolves over time.
So, Jeannie, another recommendation concerns the use of regulatory sandboxes and safe harbors. First of all, can you tell us what they are and why would they help?
Paul asked me exactly that question. What is a regulatory sandbox? Well, this concept came out of fintech, where you have a very regulated industry and new products coming out. At least that's where I came to know it, where you want to have freedom to experiment with these new products without tripping over certain prescriptive regulatory frames that don't really fit your new uses. When you do that, you have to have, in different countries that have implemented this, Singapore, UK, there are a host of them, you'll find them in the paper. You have to have someone like an ombudsman who's looking at what you have, but it gives you the freedom to experiment. The other thing, a safe harbor, a great example of that is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which has independent self-regulatory bodies which provide safe harbors for companies by doing the auditing themselves based on the statutory rules. And this frees the regulator to really hit at a lot of difficult cases, and it frees the industry to follow some rules and know that if you're following them, you are safe. And I have spent 7 to 8 years doing self-regulation. Self-regulation is not the answer to everything, right, but it is certainly a good place, particularly when you are dealing with difficult and changing issues where you don't want to regulate before you really understand and have ways of enforcement that make sense. I will just finish with the difference between the Federal Trade Commission Act, which looks at unfairness and looks at deception and can cover those changing definitions, versus the Telecommunications Act, which was enacted when there were silos about telecommunications and doesn't fit the internet time. So I really think, and I agree with Kathy, I agree with everyone here, we need a breathing space where we're working on protecting consumers, but we're giving industry the room to learn how to do this right.
Just a couple more questions, then I want to open the floor to questions and comments from the audience. So, Paul, Kathy mentioned the idea of AI audits. Is that a tool that would be helpful? And if the algorithm has, let's say, 2 million lines of code in it, like, how do you audit 2 million lines of code?
Yeah. I do think it's a good part of the toolbox. And typically, one approach to auditing is to look at the code. But a more typical approach is to look at the inputs and outputs. Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of inputs and outputs that we use for training data, but we go out of our way to make sure that we're testing it it's just a way of testing it. You know, is our performance just as good for women as it is for men? So that's the kind of audit you can do. It's still not simple, because, as in the ProPublica case, you can look at the error rates and say, error rates is a fraction of all the ones that we classified a certain way, or error rate is a function of all the ones that we should have classified a certain way. So there's work to do to decide when you're going to do an audit, which measurements you're going to take. But it's about sort of deciding, we're going to look at these measurements and see how well we're doing.
Nicole, one final question for you, then we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. AI literacy, how can we improve people's understanding of something that's very complicated and most people do not understand what an algorithm is?
Right. Paper 2. Yeah, it is a tough, I sit on the board of TPRC, and there were a couple papers around algorithmic literacy where people were sort of testing different metrics and the extent to which people could understand how the algorithm was designed. And I would actually say throw all that out the trash. Because none of us will sit there and understand the mechanics of an algorithm. I can barely understand the mechanics of how my remote works at home. I definitely can't understand the algorithm. But what consumers are concerned with are those outputs of the algorithm. Consumers need to know why they're being marketed certain things. Consumers need to know why something that they did not give the internet as a discrete aspect of who they were all of a sudden returns to them results that make no sense based on their reality, but make sense to a broader historical construction. So I always give people this example. You know, I'm a mother of two, and so when I purchase toys, the computer picks up on the fact that this is a mother of a little girl who she's buying Barbies for. And then I may purchase, you know, as part of being the mother of two, or being a mother of a young girl who buys Barbies, I may purchase the bed, or I may find myself, you know, traveling to a show. So this is a mother who has a child who has a Barbie who goes to shows. And then I may throw in and trick the computer and say I like red dresses. And so I'm putting that in there, and I may get a recommendation of a red dress. So now you figured out I'm a mother, I'm a woman who loves red dresses. And then somewhere along the line, you may infer that I might be African-American based on the types of Barbies that I buy and where I shop. But that does not mean that I want a high-interest credit card marketed to me. It does not mean that I don't want to see other products that are non-Barbie. And it doesn't mean that I want products that are only catered to single mothers. And so I think going forward, for consumers, we have to understand how these results get served back to us. And I think the beginning of literacy in this space is like when we were all growing up, and again, I always use the analogy of the ocean, we had to learn how to swim. That's right. And in this new algorithmic economy, it's important for consumers to be able to let industry or government know that that's not who I am and that's not what I want to receive. Particularly if the output of me being an African-American single mom renders the historical biases that come with women of color.
That's right.
And that's how deep you can go in the ocean of the algorithms. And which is why we need hygiene to stop that, because that's not who I am. I own everything about my life, but what I don't own are the predatory practices that get served to me. So I would say that's where, you know, I think consumers, that's a start, because I think trying to explain to consumers how to unpack it is just really difficult.
Actually, sometimes I like to throw off the algorithms as well by saying I like red dresses. Okay, let's open the floor. There's a gentleman right there on the aisle. Give us your name and organization.
Yeah, Gary Loberg, Mamluk Ventures. The question I've got is that the use of an algorithm, whether it's a company, government, whatever, it's an outsourcing of judgment. All right, you're doing it for a purpose, whether it's to make profit or to speed up your decision-making process. The question I've got from a regulatory perspective, what angle would you take on this? Anybody who's edited somebody else's paper, right? At some point, you've looked at it, and you get sucked down the hole of, I can fix it, I can change this word. When, from a regulatory perspective, do you go, hey, you need to scrap this document and actually start with a clean sheet again?
That's right.
Because that's a hard call to make, and it's a judgment, which, you know, recursively sort of defeats the purpose of the algorithm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just say that's why we developed the bias impact statement, because those questions allow you to sort of think about it, and it gives you some room, because we see it as an iterative process, for a company to go back and say, you know, we've got to shed this to pieces because this is only going to get us into further trouble, or we need to bring in different people to help us understand how this employment algorithm works, etc. But it can't, as we experience in editing, you know, the deeper that you go, you can't stop because you can continue to see stuff. But it's really important for all of us to exercise, I think, Paul put it best, this toolkit, so that we can at least come up with decisions that we can defend.
Right. And one of the things that there are a couple of things that I will just emphasize to your point, and that is we started by saying, what's the goal? Mm-hmm. How do we design to that goal? Then if we start testing, we look at the inputs to reach that goal. How good's our data? If our data isn't good enough, then we got to stop there. The editing process has to stop while we get a new typeface. If we do that and then we put it out for intelligibility and it's just not intelligible or people misunderstand the results or give the wrong results, you got to stop there. So it's a question of understanding where the danger points are, where the stopping points are, and going through the impact statement, and it's still going to be awful. But Kathy.
Can I also answer that question?
Yes.
And I think I don't disagree with anything you guys have said. The impact statement sounds interesting. But I want to just say that there's lots of laws that we have on the books that we just don't enforce. And I'm just going to give a really dumb example. Facebook has gotten into a lot of trouble for, like, allowing employers to put advertisements that, you know, don't show to old people or don't, you know, whatever. So they got rid of that practice. That's good. But I've heard this daycare provider put an employment advertisement for a job at their daycare. And 7 days in, Facebook told the daycare, we're showing this 95% of the time to women. And now I think anybody here who knows a little bit about how optimization engines work could realize that Facebook's optimization engine likes realized that more women were clicking on this ad than men, so they started just automatically showing it to more women. So that shouldn't happen. I mean, that's right. That's discrimination by gender for employment. It would be really easy for the regulator in charge of that to say, hey, Facebook, don't do that. Never show an advertisement in a 24-hour period more than 55% of the time to either men or women. You know, and I'm just throwing out 55 as a threshold thing. But like my theory, and here's where I'm, 10 years from now, every law that applies in algorithmic situations will have some kind of machine-friendly version like that.
Right.
And the question is, like, there'll probably be more laws too. But, like, how are we going to get to those definitions?
We talk about that in the paper around the non-discrimination laws. So if developers do not know the non-discrimination laws, they're not going to actually design products that actually allow them to be in compliance with them.
They're not.
Well, there's also a problem that some non-discrimination laws require intent. And so when there's no intent,
that's the problem.
There's no way of enforcing. And I'll just bring up, I'll throw a monkey wrench in, and Nicole's used to me doing that. And another problem is when we have historical data that says, and the algorithm says, mostly women work in daycare. And so we don't, in fact, have targeting that gives men an opportunity to apply for daycare jobs and vice versa in computer science. And there's a big question of how do you norm fairly and accurately and in lots of other ways to help overcome historical bias without messing with social norms too greatly.
Yeah, Paul,
any thoughts on this?
No, we can keep going.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing else for me.
Okay, in the very back. Actually, there are two questions, so we'll take both of your questions and then.
Hi, I'm Janice Gray Tucker. I'm a partner with Buckley, a law firm in D.C. We focus principally
actually,
on.
Actually, can you speak a little bit more to
me? Yep, and I'll say it again. I'm Janice Gray Tucker. I'm a partner with Buckley in Washington, D.C., and we focus principally on the financial services sector. So interesting comments about fintech. We advise a lot of companies on these issues. I probably get a question on this every day. And the issue that I'm struggling with and many companies are struggling with, particularly financial services companies, is the fact that you're talking about AI auditing, right? Auditing implies a trailing process. Mm-hmm. Financial services is special, and so are other industries, and so you may have done harm, you may have done wrong before you're even able to know that that has occurred because it's going on underneath the ocean and you're already swimming.
Yes. That's right.
So I wondered if the panel and maybe Kathy also might be able to comment on that because I'd say it's the number one question that I'm getting and trying to help banks and others step through.
Well, I would say on that question, and other people jump in, that's where I think the stage two of this is really understanding how a disparate impact analysis actually applies to the algorithmic space. So as from a lawyer's perspective, and we talked about this, has to be a legally recognizable harm. And so individual aspects of algorithms that affect people, it's a toss-up, right? I may not like the fact that the search query misidentified or further oppressed me, but it's not necessarily something I can take to court. I give a great example with the algorithms in the Russian foreign interference in the election. There was no voting. It wasn't part of the Voting Rights Act. It was a violation. There was no Supreme Court precedent where people could actually march up to the Supreme Court and say, you know, we had a VRA violation. And so it's going to require, I think, a legal analysis in terms of disparate impact. And one of the things that we talked about a lot in the paper is that people will experience differential treatment or disparate treatment. But the extent to which that treatment can be something that is legally bound is going to be another question. And I think that's a further conversation that we actually want to have in terms of what does that disparate impact analysis look like that can stand up in court, and where, to your point, in the process, does someone have the right to claim harm? Because most people who actually put an application online for a home ownership application and get rejected, you don't necessarily think it's the algorithm. You think it's the bank that rejected you. And so, you know, again, you have to have some kind of understanding that is agreed upon for someone to take that perception of harm or get recourse on what they think is a wrong.
Paul?
I just want to clarify one thing about my use of the word audit, which is much looser than the idea of a true financial audit that bring the accounting firm to come in here. This could be something that's sort of done internally and maybe even continuously. You set up some measures and you're sort of just testing all the time. So we're not waiting for ProPublica to come and do an expose.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the advice that I give. But inherently, it's trailing.
Right, yeah.
And would love to have the disparate impact conversation.
Yes, it's a disparate impact. Because you can audit along the way, but the algorithm is also picking up inferential data about the individual, just in my example. And so it's very difficult for you to determine. When we spoke about this 5 years ago at the FTC, when we were talking about that time big data and we weren't talking about algorithms, there was no one up there that had a legal precedent for taking somebody to court because your digital profile said X. Or you were, you know, I think the case was the closest case outside it was the Target case where the young woman was pregnant and her daddy didn't know because she was actually part of the advertising. They picked up on her behaviors. But to your point, where in the audit would you discover that? And is it something that the daddy has a legally recognizable, cognizable harm to say, I'm suing Target for marketing? Your daughter was pregnant. That's what they found out based on her purchasing. You know, so we'd love to talk more about it. But the paper addresses some of that.
Kathy, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I'll just say that I want to echo Paul's really important remark that you know, we can't actually measure disparate impact unless we actually have the data around race, gender, all the different protected classes. And so this idea of having a way of doing that, or actually even better, being forced to do that, is crucial. Like, I have all these, you know, typically on a given week, I have two phone calls with data scientists at highly regulated industry companies saying we probably are doing something bad. And then, you know, phone call sounds great. Second phone call, the legal counsel gets on the phone and says, we don't want to be the next tobacco company finding out that we have a problem but not knowing how to solve it. So let's just never do this analysis. And by the way, we don't even collect that information. So how can we do this analysis? So there's like probably real problems that we're not solving because we're just living in plausible deniability.
Right.
The gentleman in the very back is standing up.
Thank you. My name is George Folsom. I very much look forward to reading your paper, and thank you for the presentations today. I've got Kathy had mentioned that she would not have time today to get into an analysis of social media, but if Brookings would consider to do a comparative analysis of social media, including the likes of Google, that would be immensely well received by particularly people in Capitol Hill who are looking at this issue right now, but they need your expertise. Yeah.
Well, thank you. We'll take it on at the CTI.
Absolutely. Secondly, China introduced, I guess it was last year, a very pernicious control tool.
Yeah.
Basically scoring people on their social attributes and practices.
Yeah, that's not last year. That's
and I would imagine they use algorithms to be able to do that. And an analysis of that program would be immensely important. Thank you.
Well, Daryl does.
You're just giving us a lot of work here.
I know.
One thing I just want to mention, we haven't talked about just errors, just plain old errors when the algorithm kicks out 2,000 people who were getting welfare checks, and they don't know why they've been kicked out. And so this is just something also that when you have to test constantly, you got to catch those kinds of things. And people don't know that an algorithm is powering their check coming to them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, right here is your question.
Hi, Claire Gartland with Facebook. First of all, thank you so much for holding this panel and for, you know, taking on this really important work. I'm excited to dig into the paper a little bit more. I wanted to go back to one of the topics of suggestions that you all had made around algorithmic literacy. I think that's a really fascinating topic and one that's, you know, increasingly important. I was wondering, you know, when we're thinking about consumer interfaces, how my mom or my grandma might be educated around sort of whether it's a hiring algorithm or even the newsfeed algorithm that Kathy mentioned is quite complex, right? So Facebook has a couple of tools that we've sort of started making steps towards providing some of that transparency, like in why am I seeing this post or why am I seeing this ad that folks may have seen in different pieces in their newsfeed. But I was wondering whether you all had either examples of companies doing this well, models, or, you know, really any suggestions, because I think this is, from a company perspective, how we do this on the ground and the practical implementation of that is something I'm really interested in getting folks' thoughts on. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's so interesting because my mother will call me and say, baby, I was on Google looking for a ticket, and then I was on my Facebook and it showed up there. How did it find me on Facebook? You know, and you have to explain it. I think, you know, explaining how the computer works is important, particularly to all populations. But I do believe what you're saying, Claire, in terms of coming up with, and I was talking to somebody on Capitol Hill about this, eventually, and if you all remember with the appliance industry, where when it came to your dishwasher, refrigerator, years ago, you'd go into a store, you'd buy it, you assume, again, that the product was the best product. Now you have, like, this Energy Star rating that comes with your appliance. And that Energy Star rating includes everything from, you know, its use of electricity, its efficiency with regards to this, its battery life, whatever the case may be. I see for consumers a time where we'll see Energy Star ratings on algorithms. And those companies that do better in terms of their practices will be companies that we trust. And those companies where there are failures or feedback will be companies that we won't use as much. And they'll be, again, I think consumers in every aspect of my research on the digital divide, consumers are the ones that are driving the conversation. But they're also the ones that are eager for some type of knowledge or literacy on what's actually happening around them. And so at some point, again, I think an Energy Star rating, I'm kind of hearing some more work in there, Daryl, so I'm going to stay away from a checklist of comparisons of companies. Like, you know, there's a lot that you could actually do on this topic. But I think, again, to your point, consumers will begin to make judgments on where they want to spend their time. And, you know, again, we've got to make it fair so that all businesses can participate in where they spend their time.
Having spent 7 years trying to educate consumers about how behavioral targeting works.
Right, exactly.
And knowing that, for example, Facebook has a why did I see this ad button. It has an ad choices page where you can go look up some of the major categories in which you are being targeted. I went with Nicole to a Facebook discussion with a group of very well-educated academics, and Facebook showed everyone this this page explaining ad choice. You know, they're you're in these categories, and people treated it like this wonderful new toy. These were educated people. So how do we? These are great tools for people. How do we make sure people know about them, use them, and make the choices wisely? This hasn't been solved yet.
Right. Well, and I would just say on that too, and again, not to do another shameless plug in my book, but I do think, and as Kathy put it, that everybody has to be educated on all these things, right? These algorithms are ubiquitously deployed, and it's imperative that those that sit on the wrong side of the digital divide are also understanding what's happening to them as they actually interact with this online space, why certain products and services do not come to their community, and what they can do to regain some of that power back to sort of be part of the conversation. And as we move from this, you know, very analog world to one that's very digital, you know, I think consumer literacy is going to be very important, because you will no longer be able to go in line. You will only be able to go online. And that's going to affect the grandmothers and, you know, people who are low income and disproportionate minority going forward.
Okay, we have time just a couple more questions. You have a quick
really
comment?
Really quick. I think this is the only place where I really disagree with you guys. And I don't know if we really disagree, but I think we have to frame this really carefully. Yeah. I mean, I wrote the book, obviously, to educate the public about the algorithm harm. But it's very, very important that we distinguish that from, like, literacy of technology.
That's right.
Because it is not – I guess what I'm saying is I'm writing a book about shame now.
Yeah.
Because why? Because so many times I heard people say, it's math, you won't understand it.
Right.
People shame each other for not being technologists with PhDs in computer science.
That's
not okay. At the end of the day, this is not a literacy battle. This is about power and about knowing your rights.
Right.
So it's a political fight. So I'm just making the point that
we're actually on the same page. Yeah,
okay,
we're on the same page.
I just want to make sure that we're not saying if you don't understand the technology, you can't complain
Absolutely
about
not.
It. Because that's not true.
No. You don't know how your car runs, but you do know where the stop signs are.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a gentleman right here who
points.
Has a question. We just have time for a couple more questions.
Thank you. I'll try to live up to gentlemen. I'm with ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery, and in the interest of further scholarship and policymaking on this, in 30 seconds or less, I just wanted to note two documents that sound like they may have been underpinnings of your work and Kathy's work. The ACM Code of Ethics starts with the fundamental principle, do no harm, so thank you for noting that, Kathy, and for those who may be interested and find it useful, because we're also a non-lobbying, entirely nonpartisan organization, no stripes, we have a number of principles laid out in a statement on algorithmic accountability and transparency of May 2017. So algorithm accountability and ACM and the search term, we'll get it for you. Hopefully they'll be
useful. I've got a question for you.
You sent it to me, too.
I hope I can answer.
I have read that. I was very interested in it. What I think needs to happen, with the greatest respect, is we're trying to fill in from those very high-level concepts to something that actually you can deal with on the ground. And I'd be very curious to hear where you guys think the next step would be, looking at what we've done.
Thank you. I'm going to take that as an invitation to follow up with you and get you to come up with a list of things that I can task the 100,000 members of my association with producing.
Perfect. Thank you. Yep, and I've read your piece.
I have.
Okay, right behind him is the gentleman with the question.
Hi. Ted Knudsen. I'm a contributing writer for Forbes. Two questions. One goes to both Jeannie and Nicole. The first question is, have there been any courts or administrative law judges that have ruled on allegations that somebody was, you know, denied a job or a loan unfairly because of an algorithm?
It's in litigation right now.
In Houston.
Yeah.
In Houston, six teachers who got fired. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, right. That's right.
Yes, she cited a Houston case where that happened.
Okay, the other question is for Jeannie. You said to determine what is fair isn't a fair burden on a computer scientist. Why not? Why isn't it fair?
Because in different situations, there are different ways of measuring fairness in the sense of parity of outcome. And as Paul said, you can't have it all. Mm-hmm. When you have anything but perfectly matched groups, all the different outcome rates are not going to be the same. And add to that the problem that the data, as Kathy very eloquently said, for example, in the criminal justice system, the data that you're using is unreliable in a number of ways. So determining a fair outcome is ultimately a societal question. And a computer scientist, by his or herself, isn't going to be able to answer it in all situations. Neither is a lawyer, neither is a sociologist.
Right. And particularly if there are mostly white men. They can't do it.
Hey, Paul.
So, I mean, so the point is it is a fair burden.
Right.
To produce fair outcomes and to measure whether you're producing fair outcomes. It's not a fair burden to define fairness.
That's exactly.
And we need help for that.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And you can't. Well, they've got to diversify their. Well, I'll just say in the paper, they've got to diversify the work teams. They have to bring to the meeting people who have different disciplinary backgrounds to understand that. So, for example, and you know the reason a sociologist sitting up here. Years ago, we studied the fact that zip codes for people profiled and basically discriminated against employment. We could tell you that. There were studies that came out of the city of Chicago, University of Chicago Northwestern, where a person's name indicated a race or their address showed that they lived on the south or west side, that they were, quote unquote, unemployable. So if you're a developer who may not be a settled social scientist, or may not understand the ramifications of legal, it's really hard for you to sit there and interrogate yourself on what is actually going to be a social cost, because that's not how you're trained. You see what I mean, sir? So part of what we're pushing in the paper is if you want to design high-quality algorithms and employ an algorithmic hygiene that lends itself to more productive outcomes, bring more people to the room. Bring more people to the conversation. Test it against different scenarios. Ask people if you can collect their data. Engage in processes that allow you to do anti-bias experimentation while at the same time do auditing that ensures that during the life cycle of this algorithm, it hasn't reverted or attached itself to other data that's retraining it. In my experience, a young person who may be a data scientist today, I put this out there to all of you. Many data scientists are under 30. It's a new field for many of us. When I went to school, we didn't even have that focus. Kathy is a recovering hedge fund person and sort of repurposed her life. So we've got to find ways to diversify those channels to create much more space for better decision making in the automated world.
Paul?
Since everyone's been putting in plugs, we're starting a new program this fall, an online master's degree in applied data science.
Yes.
And I'm knee-deep in designing intro course, which we're titling Being a Data Scientist, all about, you know, what is the role of the data scientist, what are the maxims, what are the things that you should refuse to do, and it would be great to have the technical requirements for entering this are not very high. It would be great to have some people who weren't computer scientists as undergraduates who come and join this program. So maybe people in your organizations would like to.
And I will just make a plug for the old humanists. We actually looked at ethical questions, and if you were a student of Shakespeare, you saw that they weren't simple, and that the issues and decisions weren't simple. They aren't simple here, and society hasn't even made articulable choices. Kathy talks about power, and she's right. So how do we decide on what's a fair outcome, and then how do we see that that happens? That is an extraordinarily difficult question, and I'm sorry not to give you a simple answer. But ultimately, that is the who decides that we have to apply.
Well, doesn't this mean then that computer scientists need to get guidance from the regulators?
They need to do, so LaTanya Sweeney, who's over at Harvard, she teaches a class on algorithms and the AI economy, but she has embedded in that curricula a course on ethics and a course on fairness, and these are computer scientists. And so I think, again, all of this is an evolving ecology, and it's going to require, like I said, many of us didn't even have these majors when we were in school, right?
Are you saying they should be self-regulated then in terms of ethics?
It depends. I mean, let's talk about it offline, but if you look at the OECD and the UN, I think they're, as we've heard with this gentleman, people are coming up with principles. Maybe we need to figure out how they become more normative.
Okay, we have time for one more question. A lady right here.
Yeah, great question, though. We're here.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Susan Mbawike. I'm a health and social behavioral scientist from the MITRE Corporation. And my colleague here and 11 and a few of us, we're building an ethical framework that providers and healthcare systems and health insurance companies can use regarding the use of consumer-generated data. So I was just curious, in terms of the recommendations that you provide, how you see those working in the healthcare industry.
Yeah. Go ahead, please.
I would say we avoided going into different verticals because, as we said earlier, we're talking to policymakers where this has to be sort of an ABC of understanding before we got into different verticals. Mm-hmm. So, Daryl, yet another piece of work that has been added to a possible Post-it note. You know, this
this is the fifth research project we've been assigned to.
I've got another.
Right. But to your point, I mean, I think there's a lot of conversations around ethics generally. And there's been more conversation about ethics in terms of sectors. And I think the more, and this kind of goes back to the gentleman's question, the more that we have these conversations, I think the more responsible we'll be. Many of the bills that are reflected right now on the Hill are all about responsible AI, mm-hmm. multi-stakeholder collaboration. The Lipinski bill was all about getting people together, training people together. So we'd love to look at what you have as we actually go forward, because I think having the right structure will be very helpful.
And I'll just add one comment there. So certainly non-discrimination right. is a particularly important issue right. in healthcare. But I think with AI solutions in healthcare, the whole concept of informed consent is going to matter a lot. Like when you're directly engaging a physician in something and the physician can explain different things to you, you can consent at some level to that. When the decision is being made by some AI system,
right.
how do we have informed consent? Like that, I think, is a big topic. Kathy?
I'm just going to jump in and say that besides hiring, this is the thing I worry about the most. Yep. LexisNexis has a socioeconomic health score, which they advertise as not being HIPAA, not using HIPAA data, which is to say they just use consumer profile data.
Yep.
They sell this to whoever buys it. Actually, you can't buy it as an individual, only as a corporation. So I think of that as like a diabetes risk score, yep. basically.
Yeah.
So for me, what kind of kills me about people working within the healthcare situation is that they always think a doctor is going to use this to protect their patients. And I always think an insurance company is going to use this to price me out of insurance.
Yeah.
So it's like, I hope the impact statements you guys have suggested really consider context
yes.
very heavily.
Yeah, context,
like yeah. algorithms alone cannot be good or bad.
That's right.
This is one example, diabetes risk score, where it's not good or bad. It depends on the context. Yeah. It's very important.
Yeah, we talked about that. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
Okay, on that note, I want to thank Kathy, Nicole, Jeannie, and Paul. And thank you very much for coming out.